Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Wednesday, September 16th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. A short-term blip. Iowa Central fall enrollment down 8.7%. Nearly a month into the fall semester, Iowa Central Community College has seen a significant decrease in enrollment, College President Dan Kinney said. We're living in uncertain times right now, he said, attributing the decrease in enrollment to the COVID-19 pandemic. Kinney said he expected that the college would see an enrollment decrease after the second half of the spring 2020 semester had been completed through virtual online classes. Through the summer and doing orientations, I did half a dozen or more sessions with parents, and there were a lot of concerns, he said. We saw a lot of nervousness, not only in the students coming back to school, but I think parents too. Kinney said he's talked to several students who decided to take a gap year or a gap semester because they didn't feel comfortable being on campus and didn't want to take online classes. Overall, I don't like being down in enrollment, but I also understand, Kinney said. As I talk to my colleagues across the state, everybody is seeing the same. At Iowa Central this fall, there are 4,561 students enrolled in 46,285 credit hours, which includes a decrease of more than 5,000 credit hours. The majority of the decrease in enrollment and credit hours, Kinney said, comes from fewer high school students taking concurrent enrollment classes for college credit. We knew some of that would be happening with school districts having to do new return-to-learn plans, he said. So we knew some of this decrease was going to come. Part of the enrollment and credit hour decrease also comes from the partnership Iowa Central has with the Fort Dodge Correctional Facility, which allows inmates to take some Iowa Central classes online or in person with instructors at the prison through the Second Chance Pell Grant program. Because of the COVID-19 pandemic, the FDCF had to suspend the Iowa Central classes, Kinney said. We hope to see that change, he said. Right now, we're working with corrections, and hopefully in October, we can get back up and running. Kinney said he believes the setback on enrollment is just a temporary effect of the COVID-19 pandemic, and the college will continue to grow its enrollment in future semesters. I think this is a short-term blip, fortunately, he said. Hopefully, next fall will look a lot different in regards to how we can set up and how we can do business as an institution. I know there are a lot of kids out there that just want to get back to normalcy, want that normal college experience. Iowa Central Community College fall enrollment. Number of students, 4,561. Number of credit hours, 46,285. FD man hits deputy with patrol truck. Deputy treated, released from hospital, suspect in custody. A Wright County Sheriff's deputy avoided serious injury after a handcuffed suspect hit him with the deputy's patrol vehicle Tuesday afternoon in Eagle Grove, according to the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation. After being hit by the vehicle, the deputy responded by firing one round at the suspect, identified as Sean McMillan, 31, of Fort Dodge. A short time later, McMillan abandoned the vehicle and fled on foot. He was later arrested at 309 South Cadwell Street in Eagle Grove. The incident began at about 2 p.m. when the deputy conducted a traffic stop on Iowa Highway 17 at 10th Street Northwest in Eagle Grove. A deputy believed the vehicle was the suspect vehicle from a disturbance in Goldfield that the deputy had responded to, according to investigators. The deputy identified the driver as McMillan. According to the DCI, the deputy determined McMillan was driving while barred, was in possession of a handgun as a felon, and was a suspect in the disturbance call. At that time, McMillan was placed under arrest, handcuffed, and placed in the front seat of the patrol vehicle, which was a Dodge pickup truck with Sheriff's Department markings on it. As the deputy was dealing with the passenger in the suspect vehicle, McMillan jumped the center console of the truck and put the vehicle in drive. He then drove at and hit the deputy, the DCI reported. That's when the officer fired a shot at McMillan. No serious injuries were reported from the situation. As a precaution, Eagle Grove schools were placed on lockdown for much of the afternoon. McMillan is charged with escape from custody, a Class D felony. The deputy was transported to the hospital where he was treated and released. The Wright County Sheriff's Office was assisted by the Eagle Grove Police Department, the Iowa State Patrol, and the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation. Defense moves to suppress confession in prison homicide. A defense attorney for the man accused of killing a fellow inmate at the Fort Dodge Correctional Facility has moved to suppress a confession as evidence in his trial, accusing law enforcement and prosecutors from the Webster County Attorney's Office of bribing the defendant to induce the confession. The motion filed Monday by Attorney Paul Rounds for Eric Hall argues multiple grounds of constitutional rights violations. Hall, 44, has pleaded not guilty to first-degree murder in the death of former inmate Thomas Dulesky, who was found dead in his cell on June 14th. Rounds argued in the motion that Hall was questioned in violation of his right to legal counsel, had his cell searched with an overly broad search warrant, and gave a falsely induced confession to killing Dulesky when he was promised cash and a vehicle in exchange. Rounds accused First Assistant County Attorney Ryan Baldridge of directing the interrogation of Hall, engaging him in questionably ethical negotiations with an offer to return seized property and deliver other rewards through the defendant's brother. The public defender has asked the court to suppress the subsequent confessions from Hall as involuntary false statements induced by the offers. Although I cannot comment on a pending matter, generally speaking, when a defense attorney makes arguments regarding a possible suppression of evidence, they believe they are doing so in their client's best interest, Baldridge told The Messenger. Naturally, the state typically disagrees with the defendant's motion to suppress, and the judge makes the final determination. Hall was charged after the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation determined he had been inside the victim's cell shortly before Dulesky's unresponsive body was discovered. Video surveillance at the prison shows Hall entering Dulesky's cell alone and leaving 6 minutes later, according to the criminal complaint. The state medical examiner ruled the death a homicide by strangulation with blunt force injuries to the head, neck, and chest. It's unclear if any weapon was used. Rounds also argued that the search warrant granted to seize items from Hall's prison cell was unconstitutionally overbroad, authorizing large categories of evidence such as clothing, face masks, towels, bedding, trash, contraband, and hair to be collected without limitations. He also says application for the warrant did not provide any probable cause that the items were connected to the killing. The court should adopt a clearly defined objective rule that the dominance of overly broad language in a search warrant is fatal to the admission of any evidence discovered pursuant to the warrant, Rounds said. Dulesky, 59, was serving a 45-year sentence for multiple convictions out of Warren County, including sexual abuse and lascivious acts with a child. He had been incarcerated since October 2000. Hall was serving a sentence for third-degree burglary that started in April 2019 after being convicted for a rash of break-ins at businesses across the state. His release was tentatively scheduled for November 2023. Family video to close FD store. District manager, COVID to blame for drop in business. And this is an expansion of the story that was read yesterday. Family Video, the last video rental chain in the U.S., has announced it is closing its Fort Dodge store. The company made the announcement on Monday. According to District Manager Matt Rose, COVID-19 was the driving force that led to a drop in sales. Rose said 25% of the store's inventory was sold within 8 hours of the announcement. It was a zoo, Rose said. The AC unit couldn't keep up. So many people. The store will be selling nearly everything it has in the coming weeks, Rose said. According to Rose, the impact of COVID-19 was detrimental to the business. COVID killed the video store, Rose said. No new releases. Hard to bring customers in with nothing new coming out, and you do that for 6 months, it's hard. Rose has been with the family video company for 18 years. 12 of those years have been in management. He began working at the Davenport store. My college roommate worked there part-time and recruited me, Rose said. I needed a job. Rose said he has nothing but positive things to say about Family Video. It's been fantastic to work for the company, he said. They provided me with amazing opportunities. Nothing but love from me. And although stores within Rose's district will remain open, he said he is looking for a new career opportunity. "I will be parting from the company," he said. "I'm going to spend some time with my family and see what my next journey holds." The Fort Dodge store employs 5 people. Rose said the family video stores in Mason City and Waterloo would remain open. The Waverly store will close. So far, Rose said the most popular items that have sold are Nintendo Switch games. Beyond that, it's new releases, he said. But some of our Switch games are for sale for $20 or $30. In addition to games and videos, the store will be selling shelving, TVs, gumball machines, and M&M toys. Candy is half price. The sale will continue for at least the next few weeks, Rose said. Every week, the prices will go down, he said. He anticipates the doors closing for good in October. To protect and serve, Tony Ward, firefighter paramedic, Fort Dodge Fire Department. Question: how long have you been in the fire service and emergency medical service? Answer: I started my career at Trinity Regional Medical Center as an EMT in 2008. I worked as an EMT there for 2 years while working toward my paramedic certification. After receiving my paramedic certification, I continued working at Trinity for another 8 years. In 2018, I transitioned to the Fort Dodge Fire Department as a firefighter paramedic. To simplify, I have been an EMS for over 12 years and a firefighter for just over 2 years. Question: what other fire service or emergency medical service agencies have you served with? Answer: I served as a Webster County Reserve Deputy at Fort Dodge Police Reserve for 7 years. I worked very briefly at Calhoun County EMS. I worked briefly for IXP Dispatch here in Webster County. Question: what is an interesting fact about you that some might not know? Answer: I am horribly afraid of heights. Working at the fire department has pushed me to overcome this fear. We do a lot of activities that require us to be in some interesting situations very high off the ground. For example, fighting fire from the tip of the ladder truck or hanging from a rope off of the side of a 4-story training tower has forced me to work through that fear. Question: what is the most memorable incident you've responded to? Answer: in 12 years, there have been some very memorable incidents. However, I will say the most memorable calls I have been a part of were the ones that we truly make a difference in someone's life. Whether we make a life-saving intervention or help someone change their living conditions for the better by giving them options they were unaware of, being a positive part of someone's worst day makes an incident memorable. Question: what's the best part of your day? Answer: this is easy. Dinner time. We have some outstanding cooks at the fire station. Question: what gives you the most satisfaction in your job? Answer: knowing I can continue to serve the community and make a difference is what gives me the most satisfaction. Also, the camaraderie that the fire service has is second to nothing I've ever experienced in very many other jobs in my life. Knowing I can trust my life to my coworkers gives me great comfort and job satisfaction. Question: what is the toughest part of your job? Answer: the toughest part of my job is doing everything I have been trained to do to save someone's life, but losing that battle regardless. We do know as medical professionals that we can't save everyone, but it's still something that weighs on me personally. Explosion at Gilmore City home injures 49-year-old man. He was airlifted to Des Moines Hospital. A 49-year-old man suffered injuries to his hands, arms, and upper torso after an explosion was reported at a Gilmore City home Tuesday afternoon, according to the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office. The explosion was reported to the Humboldt County Law Enforcement Center at 12:51 p.m. When first responders arrived at 401 Southeast 4th Street, they located a man inside the residence with serious injuries. The man was transported to the Humboldt County Memorial Hospital by Humboldt Ambulance. He was later airlifted to a Des Moines hospital for further treatment. His current condition is unknown. The man's name is being withheld until notification to his family can be made. The Humboldt County Sheriff's Office contacted the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives and the State Fire Marshal Division to assist. The investigation into the cause of the explosion is ongoing. Gilmore City first responders and Humboldt County Emergency Management also responded. Law enforcement said the explosion is an isolated incident and the public is not in immediate danger. Supervisors okay extra funding, equipment related to pandemic. Webster County supervisors on Tuesday unanimously passed about $77,000 in funding requests for extra staffing and equipment to help two county departments weather demands for the coming months related to the coronavirus pandemic. As election season gets well underway, the county auditor's office received approval to purchase a high-speed letter opener to assist staff processing an unprecedented influx of absentee ballots. For $1,198, the Martin Yale Company machine will be able to help County Auditor Doreen Pliner and her office process up to 17,500 absentee ballots per hour. If absentee ballots for the entire county came in at once, the machine would be able to open them all in under 2 hours. That should be more than enough to assist the office, which Pliner said is processing an average of 300 request forms per day right now. Due to concerns surrounding COVID-19, she expects at least half of voters to participate in the November general election by mail. So far, her office has received about 4,500 absentee ballot requests, with more expected now that official absentee ballot requests have been mailed out to registered voters by the Iowa Secretary of State. The auditor's office will have 21 business days to mail out, receive, and process the influx of ballots between October 5th, when it's allowed to start mailing ballots, and Election Day. Webster County Public Health will also receive a few helping hands to the tune of up to $75,000 after supervisors approved the hire of temporary staff to assist with the pandemic. Supervisor Mark Campbell said the money from the General Basic Fund, which will be reimbursed by the state of Iowa with federal funding allocated through the CARES Act, passed by Congress in March, will go towards one temporary full-time staff member and 3 or 4 part-time staffers. Early on in the pandemic, Campbell said some public health staff members were moved around within the department to assist with COVID-19 contact tracing. With schools back in session and flu season coming up, he said the department would like to have them back in their regular positions. COVID-19 is not going away anytime soon, he said, wanting to be prepared if a vaccine is delivered in coming months. The goal is to get public health employees back to their daily duties while getting in front of COVID-19. News brief. Community Tap to hold Children's Cancer Charity Fundraiser. Community Tap and Pizza will be fundraising to benefit children's cancer research with each order this Friday. 10% of all proceeds from dine-in, pickup, and delivery orders on September 18th will be donated to Minneapolis-based Children's Cancer Research Fund in honor of September, which is Children's Cancer Awareness Month. Live music will be playing on the deck Friday, where dine-in customers can enjoy their orders on socially distanced picnic tables, said owner Sally Hart. Every penny counts, Hart said. Research is very important. Hart honors her granddaughter, Evie Muller, who passed away at age 4 in 2017 after a battle with cancer that started at age 2. The September fundraiser hopes to beat the $11,000 raised with the Journey of Hope steak fry in June, which also benefited cancer research. An editorial. Flu shots provide potentially life-saving protection. Everyone who can should get vaccinated. Just about everyone is called in sick at some point, saying they had the flu when they were sniffling, sneezing, maybe running a fever, and generally feeling lousy. Those symptoms definitely add up to an illness, but the problem is not really the flu. Influenza, as it is properly known, is much, much worse. According to the Iowa Department of Public Health, influenza is caused by viruses that infect the respiratory tract. Influenza and pneumonia are among the top 10 causes of death in the state. Fortunately, there is a way to prevent influenza. A yearly vaccine can protect a person from the deadly disease. Yes, getting a shot hurts. And yes, an influenza vaccine can leave a person with a sore arm for a day or two. But that seems like a small price to pay for protection against a disease that can make a person very ill and even kill them. Getting an influenza vaccine is even more important now because of the COVID-19 pandemic. With yet another respiratory disease on the loose, it just makes sense to be protected. But despite the proven protective powers of a flu shot, not everyone gets one. Public health officials would like to see 90% of those who are able to receive a flu shot actually get one. Flu shots are readily available at doctor's offices, pharmacies, and the Webster County Public Health Department. We encourage everyone to get a flu shot to protect not only themselves, but their families, friends, and coworkers from this preventable disease. Police. Murder charge dropped in Des Moines homicide case. A suspect in a shooting death in Des Moines earlier this month is no longer facing first-degree murder charges, police said Tuesday. Michael Jermaine Jacobs, 27, was charged after Sean Newman, 36, was found shot to death in a neighborhood near Drake University on September 2nd. Police had said that Jacobs shot Newman. Charges against Jacobs were dropped after new evidence found inconsistencies in statements from a witness, police said in a news release. No further information was disclosed. Whitney Ann Davis, 33, is still charged with first-degree murder in Jacobs' death. Windstorm removes 550,000 Iowa corn acres from harvest. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has estimated that 550,000 acres of Iowa corn will not be harvested this fall due to damage caused by the August 10th windstorm that swept across the state. That estimate, in a report released Friday, places the value of the lost corn crop based on the yield and price anticipated before the storm at around $344 million. Corn prices have gone up due to the crop losses, so farmers will likely get more money for the corn they do harvest. Most farmers also have crop insurance to cover some of the loss, and other federal programs may help. The storm, which cut through Iowa with winds reaching 140 miles per hour, also damaged full storage bins at farm cooperatives and on farms, taking out grain stored from last year's harvest. Iowa farmers are expected to produce 2.48 billion bushels of corn this year on 13 million acres harvested, the USDA report said. Soybean acres were not reduced due to the storm, and production is expected to be 503 million bushels. Nationally, the corn crop is anticipated to be 14.9 billion bushels, down 378 million bushels from last month's pre-storm estimate, but still the second highest production on record for the U.S. The expected national average yield of 178.5 bushels per acre will be a record high if realized. An editorial from Rich Lowry. Don't expect our elites to learn from the last Los Angeles horror. The attempted assassination of two Los Angeles County deputies caught on a security video is chilling and enraging enough. A man walks up to the parked black and white cruiser and fires point blank through the passenger window, then runs away. The stricken officers manage to stagger out of the vehicle and call for assistance. They are whisked away to the hospital for emergency surgery and are now, thankfully, recovering. The attack is a heinous and cowardly act, but what comes afterward is, if obviously much less serious, infuriating in its own right. A black man who had witnessed the Compton shooting or its immediate aftermath narrates what has happened on video, his voice filled with joy and excitement. Using a slang term for shooting someone, he exults. N-word, just aired the police out, N-word. It goes down in Compton, he continues, the cruiser and the wounded officers in the background. Oh, two sheriffs shot in the face. None of the several people on the sidewalk near the amateur videographer showed the slightest inclination to help the officers. In fact, shouts can be heard of no justice, no peace, which would seem grotesquely inappropriate, except the go-to slogan of BLM and other protesters has always carried the threat of violence. The LA shooter has yet to be apprehended, and his motive is unknown. Perhaps the attack was completely random or the attacker is mentally ill. The perpetrator of a similar ambush on officers in New York City in 2014, both murdered in cold blood, said in an Instagram post that he carried out his attack to avenge Eric Garner and Michael Brown, both killed in police-involved incidents. But there's no getting around the sentiment of the bystanders or the rabble that showed up, disgracefully, at the hospital where the officers were taken, shouting abuse at the police. Oink, oink, y'all going to die one by one. There are several things to say about this. One is that these cretins apparently hadn't gotten the message that BLM is supposedly all about reforming the police rather than expressing a comprehensive, unthinking animus to the cops. Another is that cops have to deal with these sort of spontaneous hostile crowds all the time now in the course of their work, which makes it more dangerous and difficult, with the citizens of crime-ridden areas paying the steepest price. Finally, it should go without saying that it is wrong and deeply illiberal to flatten all police officers into stereotypes. The officers shot in L.A. were a 31-year-old mother of a 6-year-old child and a 24-year-old man, both of whom had only joined the force a little over a year ago. They aren't symbols, but real people who should be honored and respected. Presumably, none of the elite members of the vast media, corporate, and cultural apparatus that has made, almost instantaneously, BLM part of America's civil religion, support killing cops or insulting them and their colleagues when they are gunned down. But in their fervent embrace of a poisonous and simplistic narrative about policing in America, they are telling a lie about the cops, one repeated over and over again and without challenge in a swath of American life. If the police are a racist occupying force, why not resist and harass them? Why not consider them all the same and all equally guilty? It'd be nice if famous people bothered to learn the names of the wounded LA officers and held them up as heroes. It'd be nice if they condemned not just the ambush, but the ensuing verbal abuse of the cops. It'd be nice if they decided to stand for the national anthem to pay tribute to the sacrifice of the LA officers and their fellow men and women in blue. But that'd require more respect for police than much of the American elite can bring itself to muster in 2020. Seeping under doors, bad air from West fires won't ease up. Dangerously dirty air spewing from the West Coast wildfires is sweeping into homes and businesses, sneaking into cars through air conditioning vents, and preventing people already shut away by the coronavirus pandemic from enjoying a walk or trip to the park. People in Oregon, Washington State, and California have been struggling for a week or longer under some of the most unhealthy air on the planet. The acrid yellow-green smog may linger for days or weeks, scientists and forecasters said. It is also a sign of things to come. With wildfires getting larger and more destructive because of climate change and more people living closer to areas that burn, smoke will likely shroud the sky more often in the future. I don't think that we should be outside, but at the same time, we've been cooped up in the house already for months, so it's kind of hard to dictate what's good and what's bad. I mean, we shouldn't be outside, period, Portland resident Issa Ubedia-Lukut said Monday. The hazy air closed businesses like Whole Foods and the iconic Powell's Books in Portland and suspended garbage pickup in some communities. Pollution and fire evacuations canceled online school and closed some college campuses in Oregon. Search to resume for mass graves of Tulsa massacre victim. A search for mass graves of victims of the 1921 Tulsa race massacre will continue at two more locations in a cemetery where a search earlier this year failed to uncover human remains, a city committee has decided. The Public Oversight Committee for the 1921 Tulsa race massacre graves investigation agreed Monday to search two areas in the city's Oaklawn Cemetery, where an 8-day search in another area ended in July with no discovery of remains. One of the areas is where a then 10-year-old boy said he saw blacks being burned shortly after the massacre, and another where old funeral home records indicate 18 blacks were buried following the massacre. Ground-penetrating radar found anomalies indicating possible graves in both areas. If the search uncovers human remains, they will be left in place while excavators look for clues to their identities and cause of death, said Phoebe Stubblefield, a University of Florida researcher who is helping orchestrate Tulsa's search. I find it very likely that we will find human remains, Stubblefield told the committee. No individuals will be removed from any burial site. We will be able to expose them enough to collect the evidence we need. The committee recommended simultaneous searches starting in late October, though no start date was scheduled. The violence in 1921 left as many as 300 dead on Tulsa's Black Wall Street, 2 years after the summer of 1919, when hundreds of African Americans across the country were slain at the hands of white mob violence during what was branded as Red Summer. You are listening to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Wednesday, September 16, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Savannah M. Heller. Savannah M. Heller, 51, of Fort Dodge, passed away Monday, September 14th, at home, surrounded by her loving family. A visitation will be 5 p.m. Saturday, September 19th, at Loffersweiler Seaver's Funeral Home, with a prayer service beginning at 6 p.m. A celebration of life will begin at 6:30 p.m. at the Moose Lodge with a potluck dinner. Please bring a dish that you can take home afterwards and table settings. Savannah is survived by her husband, Tim Heller of Fort Dodge, children, Heaven Myers, Gavin Thomas, Michaela Pearl, and Marina Hodge, all of Fort Dodge, 5 grandchildren, mother, Shirley Nawakwa, and many others she touched as extended family. She was preceded in death by her father, Harold Myers, stepfather, Daddy Joe Joseph Nawakwa, and siblings, Frank Myers, Teresa Myers, and Debbie Myers. Savannah Mae Myers was born May 1, 1969, in Council Bluffs. She attended schools in Emmitsburg and later moved to Fort Dodge. On August 28, 2009, she married the love of her life, Tim Heller. Savannah was an all-around entrepreneur, from owning and operating Swaggers with her husband Tim to working with clients at Northwoods Living as a housekeeper and art therapist, helping her husband run his karaoke business, to starting and running her own cleaning business, and had even worked in a carnival. There wasn't much that she hadn't done. Savannah was known for her outgoing spirit and love of everyone she met. She was the most non-judgmental Christian woman that was willing to help anyone in any way that she could. She was a beautiful dancer and singer. She loved to paint and draw and write poetry. Savannah was an avid gardener and loved to golf. The job she loved most of all was being a mom and grandmother to her children and grandchildren and to many more than she had at home. Family to Savannah wasn't based on blood. Family was anyone who needed a helping hand. In lieu of flowers or food, memorials may be left to the discretion of the family. M. Michael Collins. Memorial Mass will be 10:30 a.m. Thursday, September 17th at St. Francis Catholic Church in Rockwell City. Those attending the funeral mass are required to wear masks and observe social distancing. Burial will be at St. Francis Catholic Cemetery. A visitation will be 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, September 16th at the Palmer and Swank Funeral Home. The funeral service will be live streamed via Palmer and Swank Funeral Home Facebook page. Cheryl Carlson. Service is 10:30 a.m. Friday, September 18th at the Faith Bible Christian Outreach Center in Storm Lake. Visitation is 5 to 8 p.m. Thursday at Fratsky and Jensen Funeral Home in Storm Lake. Artis F. Swanson. Artis F. Swanson, 96, of Fort Dodge, died Friday, September 11th at Friendship Haven. Services will be held at a later date. Online condolences may be left at brucesfuneralhome.com. Flying high. Number 15 Wildcats off to another strong start. When a team has high expectations, coming up short often becomes the motivation to overcome an obstacle. The 15th-ranked Class 3A Humboldt volleyball squad has been on the verge of reaching the state tournament in each of the past 5 seasons, losing in the regional finals all 5 times. Only an eventual state finalist have been in the Wildcats' way each and every time. Given that, Humboldt has adopted an unfinished business moniker for 2020. It is a huge motivation for this group, said sixth-year head coach Justin McDaniel. It seems like we have had tough draws in the postseason a lot, but we keep coming back. Every season I have them write down their goals. This time around, we didn't do that. They know what they're striving for. They know what their goal is. With 8 seniors leading the way, the Wildcats have set themselves up for another run at reaching the state tournament for the first time in school history. This group, which was also coached by McDaniel from 3rd through 8th grade before reaching the high school level, won 4 AAU state titles. They have mostly been together since elementary school in multiple sports, McDaniel said. It's nice to know what to expect when they get on the court. The chemistry and cohesion is a huge advantage when they are out there playing with each other. McDaniel took over the Wildcat program during the 2014 campaign. Humboldt won the North Central Conference title 3 straight years from 2014 through 2016 and has been crowned the NCC winner in 4 of the last 6 seasons, also including 2018. "I think it's been rough not going to state but being so close," said senior Kendall Clark. "We have been such a strong team that has been together for nearly a decade. We are a very scrappy group that plays great defense, and we have consistent hitters all around. I just hope we have a full season to make it all work. Success continues to follow these Wildcats. Humboldt has already experienced state-level success in softball, track, and wrestling. We have some great athletes," McDaniel said. "A lot of these girls in the volleyball program compete in 3 or 4 sports. This group of seniors has shown great leadership in the gym and locker room. The 2021 graduating class has a combined record of 102-19 on the volleyball court as of this week, and the Wildcats are 136-21 in the last 5 seasons. Clark, Jory Hajek, Lily Grote, Kaylee Detman, Emily Zog, Denny McDaniel, Kaylee Shaner, and Jada Heffer have all provided different forms of talent and leadership through the years. Humboldt is off to a 16-0 start, losing only 4 sets during the stretch so far. We've been really lucky with this group of girls being willing to work and continue to put in time during the off-season," McDaniel said. "These girls love to play volleyball." The Wildcats didn't drop a game until 10 matches into the season versus Ballard. They won a tournament title on their home court as well as last weekend in Spencer. Hajek, who earned All-State Honorable Mention status the past 3 seasons and is a 3-time NCC First Team member, is tied in the state for lead in serve efficiency at 100%. Hajek is a perfect 170-for-170 from the service line. "This is such a close group," Hajek said. "We have been playing together since we were in 3rd grade, and we have a bond that is unimaginable. We get along so well and have each other's back in everything that we do. All of us being multi-sport athletes means we also have a lot of versatility, both physically and with our mindset. We can be put in all different positions, and it will all work out. Our underclassmen put in so much hard work, too, and make us better in every practice." Hajek also leads the Wildcats with 115 kills and 151 digs. Clark has 98 kills, and Zog has 20. Dig leaders are McDaniel with 135, Clark at 124, and Grote with 100. Zog leads the way in blocks with 19. McDaniel's daughter, Denny, a first-team all-conference pick a year ago, is 2nd in 3A and 7th in the state with 327 assists. Wildcats last won the NCC crown in 2018 as Clarion Goldfield Dows, a state semifinalist last season, was the 2019 champion. The Wildcats will travel to Clarion to face the 3rd-ranked Cowgirls on October 15th. During the COVID-19 pandemic, athletes are just grateful to be on the court. "Being so close to state for the past 5 years, I know my class especially wanted to overcome that hump we have had troubles with in the past," Hajek said. "If anything, we have more desire and fire to want to overcome that last step and make this crazy year all worthwhile. This team has dreamed about being the first Humboldt team at state. The fact that we get to play the game we love this year means everything to us. So why not make it last as long as possible?" Fierke, Hartley, victorious. The Fort Dodge swim team earned 2 individual victories against 5th-ranked Ankeny on Tuesday. Sophomore Eileen Fierke and senior Grace Hartley picked up golds for the Dodgers. Fierke won the 200 freestyle in 1 minute 59.62 seconds by 6/100ths of a second over Ankeny's Madison Carlton. Hartley outtouched Ankeny's Caroline Walker at the wall in the 100 butterfly, prevailing by 1/100ths of a second with a final time of 1 minute 4.14 seconds. Hartley was also 2nd in the 50 freestyle at 26.61 to Alexis Henning. "With getting ready for our own invite this week, we wanted to swim in some different events and give the girls a chance to relax," said FDSH head coach Ashley Beaumont. "Eileen and Grace had awesome races. It was nice to see them go up against some of the state's best." The Dodgers are back in action on Saturday when they host the Gary Winkler Invitational. The meet begins at noon. Dodgers competitive versus No. 2 Jags. For one game on Tuesday night, the Fort Dodge volleyball team was playing tight with the 2nd-ranked squad in Class 5A. The Dodgers went toe-to-toe with number 2 Ankeny Centennial in the first set, falling 26-24 in the opener. The Jaguars went on to sweep the Dodgers 25-6 and 25-17. "We were right there with them in Game 1," said FDSH head coach Martha Miracle. "We are improving, but we are not where we want to be yet. We missed at least 6 serves, and you just can't give away free points to good teams. Everyone's enthusiasm was high, and we were playing loose. We played with a lot of energy, but to lose on a hitting error knocked the wind out of our sails." Kiana Tooney led the Dodgers with 9 kills. Lainey Mayo added 5. Olivia Bell tallied 10 assists, while Maggie Elsbecker recorded 8. Cheyenne Miller-Hamid and Tori Bennett were both 9-for-10 serving. Brooke Hansen was 5-for-5. Bennett had 8 digs. Miller-Hamid had 5. "We are still making mistakes that we shouldn't make," Miracle said. "We got into too big of a hole and we couldn't pull it off." The Dodgers host the Jackie Wild Invitational this Saturday. Meyer places third for Dodgers. Fort Dodge senior Josh Meyer turned in a top-5 performance in Storm Lake on Tuesday. Meyer finished in fourth place with a time of 17 minutes 46 seconds. He was nearly 5 seconds behind third-place finisher Jason Stutledge of Lamar's, who had a time of 17 minutes 41 seconds. Harlan's Trey Gross, at 17 minutes, was the winner, while Sam May of MOC Floyd Valley, with a time of 17 minutes 20 seconds, was second. Lamar's won the team title with 38 points, while MOC Floyd Valley was the runner-up. The Dodgers finished 8th. Ryan Madden, with a time of 19 minutes 2 seconds, was 21st, while Carter Dillonois took 29th at 19:24. Also competing for the Dodgers was Nathan Redwish, 62nd in 21 minutes 47 seconds, Jaron Christie, 66th in 22:17, Grant Harrison, 76th in 23:38, and Zeke Pineda was 77th in 23:47.58. The Algona boys were 6th. Ryan Stundahl was 9th in 18 minutes and 10 seconds. "We had another great race," said FDSH head coach Joe Jackson. "Most of our runners posted personal records for this course or personal records for this year. Josh led with a fourth-place finish against some top 3A competitors. Algona was 4th with 118 points in the girls' race. Harlan was the team champion at 38. Fort Dodge took 10th. For the Bulldog girls, Mariah Knapp earned 5th with a time of 20 minutes 54 seconds, and Carly Mullins with 22:07 was 13th. Alexis Reed, 24 minutes 1 second, paced the Dodgers in 27th place. Also competing for Fort Dodge was Isabel Beekman, 38th in 24:29, Maddie Daniel, 46th in 25:03, Hannah Drummond, 62nd in 26:59, Morgan Bodholt, 65th in 27:15, Asia Jallo, 75th in 29:43, and Briley Frank, 76th in 30 minutes 48 seconds. Gale MS team tops Fort Dodge. The St. Edmund Middle School 7th and 8th grade football team defeated the Fort Dodge 7th grade squad on Tuesday at the Fort Dodge Middle School. The Gales rolled to a 36-0 triumph. Kinnick Henning caught a 20-yard touchdown from Ethan Swisher, and Sam Meyer added the 2-point conversion. Meyer and Mason Billingsley both had 5-yard touchdown runs. Drake Vandy added a 2-point conversion run. Clay Baker and Grant Gallus had touchdown jaunts of 10 and 3 yards, respectively. The Gales also recorded a safety. Gallus also had a 20-yard touchdown catch from Jackson McElroy. The Gales are back in action on Tuesday when they host Hampton Dumont at 4:30 p.m. Lakeside One Man. Lakeside Golf Course will be hosting a one-man scramble on Sunday. Each person plays 2 balls and then their best shot. The event begins at 10 a.m. with a shotgun start. Cost is $30 per person. For more information, call 515-576-6741. Pelosi, House to stay in session until COVID-19 Rescue Pact. Speaker Nancy Pelosi said Tuesday the House will remain in session until lawmakers deliver another round of COVID-19 relief, a move that came as Democrats from swing districts signaled discontent with a standoff that could force them to face voters without delivering more aid. We are committed to staying here until we have an agreement that meets the needs of the American people, Pelosi said on CNBC. Pelosi told her Democratic colleagues on a morning conference call that we have to stay here until we have a bill. That's according to Democratic aide speaking on condition of anonymity, but authorized to quote her remarks. The move highlighted the extent to which coronavirus legislation has settled into a kind of suspended animation in the final legislative weeks before the November election. Both parties insist they want action, keeping the idea of new relief alive, but negotiations between Democrats and the White House remain frozen, with both sides entrenched in their positions. Pelosi's comments came as moderate Democrats, many from areas won by President Donald Trump 4 years ago, signed on to a $1.5 trillion rescue package endorsed by the Bipartisan Problem Solvers Caucus, a group of about 50 lawmakers who seek common solutions to issues. The plan contains many elements of COVID rescue packages devised by both House Democrats and Republicans controlling the Senate, including aid to schools, funding for state and local governments, and renewal of lapsed COVID-related jobless benefits. The price tag is significantly less than the $2.2 trillion figure cited by Pelosi, but it's also well above an approximately $650 billion Senate GOP plan that failed last week due to Democratic opposition. Talks between Pelosi and the Trump administration broke down last month, and there had been little optimism they would rekindle before Election Day. And last week, Senate Democrats scuttled a scaled-back GOP coronavirus rescue package. Pelosi has maintained a hard line in negotiations and has been at odds with White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. She orchestrated passage of a $3.4 trillion COVID rescue package back in May, but the effort was immediately dismissed by Senate Republicans and the Trump administration. Tuesday's remarks, said Pelosi spokesman Drew Hamill, don't mean that the speaker is adopting a more flexible position. She instead seems to be signaling continued determination to press ahead and won't adjourn the House without an agreement with the administration. Success is by no means guaranteed, and many people on Capitol Hill remain skeptical that an agreement between the White House and Democrats is likely before the election. My sense is the clock is running out, said Senate GOP Whip John Thune of South Dakota. I don't see any intention or desire on the part of the Democratic leadership at the moment, regardless of what their members are saying, to cooperate and to work together on a solution. I think they feel like they've got the issue and they want to try and right it in November. EPA sides with farmers on ethanol, rejects refinery waivers. Federal regulators on Monday handed a victory to corn farmers and the renewable fuels industry by refusing to allow a group of petroleum refiners in 14 states to forego requirements to blend ethanol into the gasoline they make. Members of Congress from farm states have heavily lobbied President Donald Trump to reject the waiver requests for months. Those representing oil-producing states supported the waivers, which were originally designed to help small refiners that struggled financially to meet federally mandated ethanol targets. In recent years, however, larger refineries also have received exemptions from the Trump administration. The petroleum refiners had sought 54 exemptions retroactively, some as far back as 2011, that would have allowed the petroleum industry to remove hundreds of millions of gallons of corn-based ethanol from the market. Significant exemptions from the congressional requirement of blending at least 15 billion gallons of ethanol a year into the nation's fuel supply began after Trump took office and appointed Andrew Wheeler as administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency. By agreeing to reject the waivers, the Trump administration is essentially fixing a problem it created. Congressional Republicans, including Iowa Senators Joni Ernst and Chuck Grassley, nevertheless lauded Trump for the decision. I applaud President Trump for keeping his word and supporting our farmers and biofuel producers, Grassley said in a statement. Democratic Representative Abby Finkenauer agreed the EPA decision will help Iowa farmers, but called out the Trump administration for approving previous waivers that removed 4 billion gallons of ethanol from production and waiting until 50 days before an election to finally take even this modest action. A petroleum industry group response was critical of EPA and Trump. The notion that this administration is following the rule of law through its latest betrayal of U.S. refinery workers is laughable, said Chet Thompson, CEO of the American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers, a trade group for producers of fuel and petrochemicals used in many products. While maintaining the ethanol production levels, the EPA decision also is likely to bring an end to the small refinery exemptions that have plagued the ethanol industry. If the decision isn't appealed, or if it is upheld on appeal, only a few small refineries would remain eligible for waivers, said Monty Shaw, executive director of the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association, a trade group. About 40% of the nation's corn crop is used for ethanol, making such decisions critical for the economy of Iowa, the nation's leading corn and ethanol producer. Many farmers who grow corn were early investors in the ethanol industry and have significant stakes in the industry. Apology, no firing. Official said U.S. scientists hurt Trump. A Trump health appointee who is accused of trying to muzzle an important scientific publication in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic apologized Tuesday for a separate video in which he reportedly says scientists battling the virus are conspiring against President Donald Trump and warns of shooting in America if Trump loses the election. Michael Caputo, the top spokesman for the Department of Health and Human Services, apologized to his staff for the Facebook video, said an administration official who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss internal matters. The department is standing by Caputo so far in the face of calls by congressional Democrats for his dismissal and for the resignation of his boss, HHS Secretary Alex Azar. But Caputo, a Trump loyalist and former New York political operative, has become a significant new problem for a White House that has struggled all year with its coronavirus response. He can be heard on an HHS podcast asserting that Democrats don't want a coronavirus vaccine before the election in order to punish Trump. Although Trump has made the same assertion with no evidence to support it, such broadsides are not in a department spokesman's normal portfolio. News reports alleged last week that Caputo's office tried to take over and muzzle a scientific weekly from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that publishes what is supposed to be authoritative, unvarnished information about disease-fighting efforts, including, most importantly at present, COVID-19. Then on Monday came an account of the video on Caputo's personal Facebook page in which he accused government scientists of conspiring against Trump and suggested violence could break out after the election. Caputo was named the top HHS spokesman in April during a tense period in relations between the White House and HHS Secretary Alex Azar. On a taxpayer-funded podcast earlier this summer, he accused Democrats and the media of not wanting a coronavirus vaccine until after the elections in order to defeat Trump. There are people in the United States government on the Democrat side who do not want a vaccine, he said. They don't want a vaccine until November 4th, he added, citing the day after the presidential election. It's highly unusual to use an agency communications platform for such a blatantly political message. Over the weekend, Caputo made headlines when Politico and the New York Times reported that his office had tried to gain control over a CDC publication known as the MMWR, or Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. In previous administrations, political appointees in the HHS Secretary's office maintained a hands-off policy. The story took a strange turn Monday after the Times reported about a live video hosted by Caputo on his personal Facebook page. In it, Caputo reportedly accused government scientists of conspiring against Trump as part of a resistance. The message turned apocalyptic when Caputo reportedly predicted that Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden would refuse to concede defeat to Trump in the election and violence would break out. The Associated Press was unable to independently view the video. HHS supported Caputo with a statement calling him a critical, integral part of the president's coronavirus response, leading on public messaging as Americans need public health information to defeat the COVID-19 pandemic. There was no immediate statement from the White House. Attempts to interview Caputo were unsuccessful. On Capitol Hill, Senator Patty Murray, a Democrat from Washington, called on Azar to fire Caputo, accusing the spokesman of trying to interfere with CDC reports. and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat from New York, called on Azar himself to resign, citing interference with the CDC as one example of what he termed the administration's failures. Officials at CDC have privately complained of recent efforts by political appointees at HHS to try to edit or press for changes in the agency's weekly MMWR publications, a go-to resource for public health professionals. MMWR articles are technical, but they reveal telling details. One published earlier this year noted that while Trump's travel restrictions dramatically reduced travel from China in February, nothing was done at that time to restrict travel from Italy and Europe, where the coronavirus was spreading widely and rapidly. Analysis of virus samples from hard-hit New York in March suggested it was introduced there from Europe and other parts of the U.S., the CDC article reported. Caputo is an unswerving Trump loyalist. His recent book, The Ukraine Hoax, claims the president's phony impeachment was rooted in a vast conspiracy. His appointment at HHS was seen as an attempt by the White House to exert more control over Azar, whom other administration officials were trying to blame for the government's slow response in the initial weeks of the pandemic. At HHS, he's been closely affiliated with Operation Warp Speed, the government's effort to have millions of doses of a COVID-19 vaccine ready for distribution as soon as one is approved by the Food and Drug Administration. Caputo interviewed Dr. Mansaf Slaoui, a top outside advisor to the vaccine effort, on an HHS podcast July 31st. Commiserating with Slaoui over Democrats and news articles that were critical of the doctor, Caputo said, "I know that's hard to believe, but the people who are abusing you and who are beating down Operation Warp Speed and the incredible historic work that's going on, they don't want a vaccine until November 4th. I don't want to talk about politics here, but November 3rd is an important day. They don't want a vaccine now because of politics, sir." And that does it for today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Wednesday, September 16th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.